boys and girls, welcome back. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Henrik Pange, and this is Red Ice TV. You have also, of course, a radio version available of this show if you so prefer. It's great to have you with us today. We have a special segment together with, well, one of the co-hosts of Norse News, which I definitely hope you've checked out by now. We're actually up in the third episode at this point. But we have Ingrid Carlqvist with us on the line today, and we're going to talk a bit about some of the things that have unfolded in the Swedish press over the last week or so. She was basically drawn into a controversial issue of her raising some very important points when it comes to, you know, Swedish multiculturalism and what it is that we really are faced and what it is that we're battling in Sweden, you know, when it comes to the transformation of Swedish society. And it's really important, and I also just want to mention this, that, you know, Ingrid is a very talented journalist. I mean, she's like a bloodhound, you know. She's been digging into issues over the years and not let go. When she gets on a trail, she follows through and she catches her prey, so to speak. And in this case, it's really the same thing that has happened. So we're going to try to detail this today and try to outline for you exactly what it is that happened and the kind of the chronology of this. So welcome to the show, Ingrid. Thank you so much for coming on with us again.
Thank you very much, Henrik. Thanks for having me.
So tell the audience first, what happened and how did this begin for those who haven't followed the Swedish press?
Well, it actually began, I think, we have to go back to February, when I had a speech in Gothenburg. Some people wanted me to come and speak about a book that I plan to write. The working title of my book is From Sweden to Absurdistan. And I want to, you know, try to understand, how did this happen? How did we go from 1965, when our prime minister said, we are so lucky in Sweden because we are a homogeneous country, not only according to the race, we are so lucky. And then 10 years later, in 1975, the Swedish parliament decided that Sweden was not going to be a Swedish country anymore, but a multicultural one. And we've all seen what has happened since then. So the focus of my work, what I want to find out is, how did this happen? How did we go in just 10 years from a prime minister praising the homogeneity of Sweden to the parliament saying that Swedish is not good, we want to be a multicultural country? And when I, researched this subject, I found out that it all started in October 1964 with an op-ed in one of the biggest Swedish newspapers called Dagens Nyheter, the Daily News. And it was written by a Jewish man called David Schwartz. And he had come to Sweden in 1950 or so. He had been a prisoner in a concentration camp in Germany. And he came to Sweden and he started his life here. And he quite quickly became a figure that people knew about. You know, he was very active. He wanted to do good things for immigrants in Sweden. And after a few years, he became the editor of a newspaper called something like Immigration and Minorities. And in October 1964, he wrote an op-ed in one of the biggest Swedish newspapers where he call for multiculturalism in Sweden, because as he saw it, the Jews were a little minority in Sweden, but of course they had been here for 200 or 300 years, and after the war there came other Jews, but we had a Jewish population, very small, but a Jewish population that had lived in Sweden for 200 or 300 years. But he saw the majority society as a threat to minorities. So his suggestion was that Sweden would turn into a multicultural country, so there would be many minorities in Sweden, so the Jews would not be the only minority, so we wouldn't think badly of them. Of course, I mean, I'm just, shortening it down, but that was really his mission.
Yeah, it's a, in a way, it's a, I guess it's a tactic as an ethnic minority to kind of protect yourself, right? To make sure that you're not singled out and maybe that you're targeted and considering then the, you know, the history and these kinds of things was a way for them to protect themselves. But of course, in the wake of this, what they have to recognize is also that then it leads to the destruction of a nation, which can also actually cause people to be antagonistic towards this kind of behavior, right?
Mm-hmm. And what I think that I'm not sure that he wanted to destroy the Swedish people. I think he was, I have actually talked to people who knew him in the 80s, and they say that at that point he was not very happy with the mass immigration into Sweden. So maybe he had remorse. Maybe he thought that what he started didn't really work out very well. So we have to, you know, think that maybe he didn't know what he was doing. But if you have an ethnic group, a minority, who wants to have, you know, a better place in society, a better, I don't know what to call it, you know, yeah, a better place in society that, that people don't single you out and so on. So it's quite normal for you to say that my ethnic group would profit from other ethnic minorities, because the Swedish majority, maybe they will not like the Jews, so, but if we bring new minorities into the country, then they will not just think about the Jews, and that would be good for the ethnic Jewish interests. But what you have to understand, if you do good for one ethnic minority, you will do bad for another, for the ethnic majority. And that is exactly what we see now, 40 or 50 years after his first article about this. We see that the Swedish people are to become a minority in our own country because of what started in 1964. And this is what I said in my speech in Gothenburg in February, and there was a person there, Jan Funnesson, and he is sort of a journalist, sort of a patriot, and he was there to write about my speech for one of these alternative media sites called Avpixlat, but he never wrote anything. So I thought, okay, maybe this was too much for him. Because, you know, there are people who say, you can talk about everything. You can talk about mass immigration. You can talk about Islamization. But don't mention the Jews. If you do that, you are like this.
It's a third rail, right? You die if you touch it, as they say.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was very, you know, nervous before I held my speech. I actually said to the audience that they gave me a big applaud when I came up on the stage, and I said to them, thank you very much, I hope you are going to applaud when I'm finished, because I really didn't know how they were going to react. Maybe they would boo, maybe they would throw rotten tomatoes at me or something like that, but everything went very well, and most people applauded very, very hard, you know, and they really liked it. But this person, Jan Funnesson, he just disappeared very quickly, and he never wrote about it. So I thought, okay, this was too much for him. He doesn't want anyone to talk about the Jewish, you know, how the Jews had some effect on what has happened in Sweden. So and nothing ever happened until a week ago, and then he suddenly wrote an article on his blog saying that I don't want to have anything to do with that anti-Semitism that comes from Ingrid Carlqvist and Avpixlat, the site where he where he works, because they also, they actually had an article with the same content as I said in my speech in Gothenburg about David Schwartz and about that article from October 1964. So he felt the need to write that he didn't support me or Opiklat when they wrote about the thing about the Jews.
Yeah. And of course, this is a proposition 1975-26. This is the official proposition that David Schwartz helped to create in Sweden. And of course, this initiated the process of Sweden slowly becoming and adopting a multicultural viewpoint and official stance as a country. And I believe that you're right when you say that this is what we're living through today is the not even the final process, but it's in the midst of the true effects of this proposition that date back so many years ago. And you have a similar one, of course, in America, the Hart-Celler Act, where you also actually had a Jew part of writing that. It's just a fact. I mean, it's like, if we can't talk and discuss about reality of this, I don't know where to begin with some of these people, especially, of course, when they're free speech advocates. That it's like, and that's why my point that I mentioned about you, Inger, that you have been kind of a you go on a trail and you follow through on that. You let the truth lead you where it will, right? And in this case, it leads to David Schwartz. It leads to that person transforming Swedish society. And I think that we should be able to talk about that. I think we should be able to recognize the reality of that.
Well, of course. I mean, as a journalist, I think that you always have to have the truth as your star, where you're heading. And it's been like that for me ever since I was 18 years old and started in the school of journalism. So it may sound pathetic, but that's really true. I always wanted to find the truth, and I've never, if everyone is running to the right, I turn to the left to see what is there. Because I really don't like, when people get into this frenzy where everybody is writing about, for example, pedophilia. Everyone is a pedophile. All daddies are pedophiles and so on. And I really don't like that. I want to see what is on the other side, because I don't like when people get, hysterical about something. Mm. And so I've always tried to see where is the truth. And I don't really care about being popular.
Yeah.
Most people want to be popular. They want to be loved. They want to be liked. They want everybody to, pat your back and say, oh, you're wonderful, Ingrid. I've never really cared about that. What I care about is I think I was born with a talent. Or some talents. I have a talent for writing in a way that most people understand. I don't try to, write in a very difficult language. I want everybody to understand what I want to tell them. And I also have the ability to speak to people in a way that they understand. So I think that my mission in this life is to, when I find out some things, when I understand something, it is my duty to tell other people about it. And many times people will say, we don't like you. We don't like what you are telling us. We don't want to hear this. But that doesn't matter to me, because I need to tell it anyway. And most of the times, after 10 years or 20 years, they will say, okay, you were right. We're sorry we didn't listen to you. But that's okay. I just feel this is my talent in life and this is my duty to do it.
Absolutely. And I mean, I think the truth is the noblest quest one can have. And truth is not always polite. And yes, even from a strategic point of view, sometimes it isn't the correct thing to apply truth. Sometimes we amend it to preserve relationships and things like this. But as a journalistic integrity, as an effort, this surely has to be at the front line of this, right? So the critique that you received is basically you're not allowed to talk about this. If this is where things go, it's off the table. You're not allowed to talk about it. So I'm wondering what relationship can we have to a subject like this when it comes to how Sweden became multicultural without discussing and recognizing the reality of the situation? Because it's not that these sources that have criticized you have argued on the points that you brought up themselves and said, listen, you're factually incorrect, this is what happened, blah, blah, blah. No, that's not the case at all. In this case, it's just you are now a horrible person because you have recognized something that we are not allowed to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. And that makes me really, really sad because, you know, for many years I have been talking about the dangers of Islam and Islamization. And a lot of people, of course, they called me an Islamophobe, but I have had a lot of fans saying that, oh, what you're doing is so important, and think about what the Muslims do to the Jews in Sweden, they harass them and so on. But now when I found out that there's something strange going on with how the Jews are operating in Sweden, and then now I'm not only talking about David Schwartz and what he did in 1964, but what the Jewish leaders in Sweden, not all Jews, I'm not talking about all Jews, I'm talking about Jewish organizations and Jewish leaders. Something strange is going on with what they are doing. And when I say that, people go crazy. I mean, all the people who said, oh, you don't hate Muslim, we understand everything you're saying. You want to criticize Islam. That's your right, freedom of speech, la, la, la. And now when I say, okay, but there's something strange going on with the Jewish leaders, they are not scared of the Muslims. They are actually working for mass immigration into Sweden.
Right.
And then all some of the people who said, that is so good what you're doing, just go after the Muslims and so on, or after Islam. Now they say, you're horrible, Ingrid. You can't do that. Well, I'm doing just the same as I did all the time. I am finding out who are the bad guys. Why are they doing this to our country? But if you talk about Muslims, okay, you will be called an Islamophobe, but a lot of people will say, great, do it. But if you mention the Jews, you know, now I just got into my head, you know, where, Fawlty Towers and John Cleese, when he says, don't mention the war.
Don't mention the war, that's right.
Yeah,
I remember that thing.
The same, don't mention the Jews.
Yeah.
Because if you do that, you're...
Right, right. And again, it's, you know, to... But also this aspect that this has to be prefaced, and that's okay, that's fine, you know, we have to talk about this, and there's a lot of sensitivity around this issue, and you know, because of the way that we're taught and the history we're taught, we have a special emotional bond, almost like a trauma around the subject, that which has made it, as I said, a third rail, a one you can't touch, and if you do, you die. Mm-hmm. But the fact is, we can discuss... no matter what people think about this, we can discuss the reality of this, we can discuss and theorize... Is there an ethnic interest, you know, from the many other people that push multiculturalism in Sweden? And again, if we're not allowed to discuss that, I don't know how to approach people, because it's the same thing as if we had Islamic factions, which of course we do, but let's assume that we had them at prominent positions within the media, they were in prominent positions in politics or lobbying or these kinds of positions. People like yourself would have pointed this out, and that's not a crime to do. It's just recognizing the reality and saying, listen, here's a lot of people, they're not Swedish, they have their own group, they belong to their own group, that's fine, but are they transforming and influencing and changing Swedish society? And if so, we are going to talk about that. There's nothing strange about that. That's not a crime, but my point is the associations of all of this has now made it to almost become a crime, right? That you see the response, the reflex that people have and recoil in horror when you like dare to address the issue, that is very strange to me. It's almost like people are almost mind controlled. We're just talking about the reality of this thing. This is not a crime. What's going on here?
This is what makes me very, very sad. You know, first of all, I want to say that for many, many years, I couldn't understand how anyone could say anything about the Jews, because I had the image that all Jews in Sweden, they were assimilated. I thought they were Swedes, They were praying to another god, but most of them were secular. They didn't really believe in God, so I thought there was no difference. And I really didn't. This is, I must tell you, of all the things, as I've told you, I have written about things that nobody else wanted to write about, fathers being accused of incest and so on. Really, you know, the stuff that doesn't make you popular. But the thing about the Jews, I couldn't even think that there was something like this going on. And the first time I ever heard about this was in a radio interview with a station called, I don't know, Diana Spingola or something like that?
Yeah, Spingola Speaks. I remember that. I actually listened to parts of that show. It's funny, though. And this is what you're getting at. You went through a similar realization yourself. A lot of this material was not... it was brought to your attention, sometimes by almost in a hostile way. In other times, it was just, hey, look at this. What's going on here? You know, curiosity, right? What's going on here? But tell us about the radio show a bit more. We can listen to a clip here later, too.
Yeah. I mean, she sent me an email asking if I and my co-editor, Lars Hedegaard, wanted to be on her radio show. And we just started Dispatch International, and we thought, well, okay, that's good. If someone in America wants to listen to us and what we want to do with this newspaper, fine. So I didn't really do any research, you know. What is the Spingola Speaks? I just thought, oh, that's a radio station. That's okay. And she called us up, and we sat actually together in Copenhagen, me and Lars Hedegaard, and we talked, I think, for 1 hour about mass immigration, the problems with Muslims and Islam, and then suddenly she says, well, what about Barbara Spector, the Jewish person in Stockholm, what she says about multiculturalism? And we were, you know, like looking at each other, saying, what? What? Who? What are you talking about? Who is Barbara Spector? And she said, well, you must know. She's a sort of a big Jewish leader, and she says that Europe has to become multicultural. If they don't do, they will die. And we were saying, we don't know what you're talking about. And then she played the clip, and I think you have what happened after that.
Yeah, should we play the the Barbara Spector clip first, so people can see, for those who haven't seen it? So check this out, folks.
As we heard, there are people in Sweden who support Israel and have a deep sense of the injustice of the present situation. It's these people who give hope to those who still believe that things will get better here. One of them is Barbara Spector, a former American who made Aliyah and then, 10 years ago, with the help of the government of Sweden, set up a non-denominational institute of Jewish learning with the Greek name of Paideia, here in Stockholm. She believes the current wave of anti-Semitism in Sweden will pass, and that Jews have an important role to play in a country undergoing profound change.
I think there's a resurgence of anti-Semitism because at this point in time, Europe has not yet learned how to be multicultural. And I think we're going to be part of the throes of that transformation, which must take place. Europe is not going to be the monolithic societies that they once were in the last century. Jews are going to be at the center of that. It's a huge transformation for Europe to make. They are now going into a multicultural mode, and Jews will be resented because of our leading role. But without that leading role and without that transformation, Europe will not survive.
I mean, that's pretty bold, right? That's a pretty bold statement. I don't know how she can talk in one sense for all Jews, which she does, but I guess she knows something we don't. But should we listen to the reactions of you and Lars at the program, right? It's pretty interesting.
Please do.
Let's listen to this here, folks.
I'm Barbara Spector.
Spector,
She's promoting multiculturalism in Sweden. She set up an organization there 10 years ago to do that, and that she says that people are pretty upset about it, and they're pretty upset at the Jews because the Jews seem to be the ones that are promoting it, and that's why there's so much anti-Semitism in Sweden.
But that's so true, Diana, because nobody's heard of this Barbara Spector. And, you know, we have problems with anti-Semitism, but that is not from the native Swedes. The new thing that's happened is that we have so many Muslims in the country now, and they hate Jews. You know that. That's part of their so-called religion. And especially in my town, Malmo, we have the Jews are fleeing from the town because they can't walk outside with the kippahs, for example, because Muslim youth are throwing stones at them, calling them names and harassing them in all ways. So the anti-Semitism is not from native Swedes, it's from Muslims from all over the world that are now staying in Sweden.
So, I mean, and that's true on one level, right, that there are actually many Jews in Malmö that have been forced to leave, but it's not the Barbara Spectors that are affected by the policies that they are incorporating or pushing on Sweden, right?
To tell you the truth, when I saw that clip, when she sent that clip to me, I was in shock, in total shock. I had never heard anyone, Swede or Jew or Muslim, saying anything like this. It's absolutely preposterous what this person is saying. She actually says that we need to become multicultural and the Jews are going to be in the forefront and they will be resented because the Europeans won't like it, but this is the only way, because if the Jews don't go fixing this multiculturalism, Europe will die.
How is that? This is not prefaced, of course, in this documentary. It's a clip, by the way, that we watched from an Israeli broadcasting company, and they were actually vehemently going after anyone who actually referenced this clip for the longest time on YouTube. There's even a court case in Britain right now referencing one of the videos where Barbara Spector is mentioned in, and I believe it's still her and some other people trying to get Google and YouTube, which Google owns, to stop all of these kinds of clips from being out there. But she's the one who said it. We were not saying this. It's her words, right?
Absolutely. And what I thought, when I first saw it, after Diana Spingola sent it to me, you know, I was in shock, but I thought, who is this person? I have never heard about her. I mean, I'm a Swedish journalist. If she was an important person, I would have heard about her.
Right.
But
right.
That was not the case. Afterwards, when I started to research this person, I understood that she was the headmaster of a Jewish learning institute called Paideia. Now she just resigned just a few months ago. They changed headmaster. But she was the headmaster for more than 10 years. And how did this Paideia Institute happen? Why did it come to be? Well, it was like this. The Jewish organizations in Sweden, they said to the government, again and again, we believe that your central bank were dealing with looted gold, Nazi gold, during World War II, and then you owe us money. So the Swedish government, they actually did two or three investigations into this to see, was it true? Did the central bank actually deal with looted gold? And the answer was, again and again, no. There were no proof of this. But these Jewish organizations, they didn't settle for that. So finally, the government decided that they were going to give this Jewish organization 40 million kroner. That's about $4 million.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Not because of looted gold, because there was no looted gold, but as a gesture of kindness.
It's bribe money, right? It's blackmail, effectively, emotional blackmail.
Yeah, and what I have found out, and this I will publish in a few months, but I will give you a preview of this.
Nice.
I found out that when they were negotiating with the Swedish government, they told the government, if you don't give us this money, we have behind us, we have the World Jewish Congress. And if you don't give us the money, we will tell all the world that Sweden is anti-Semitic.
Oh, God.
That's how they got the money. So they gave them 40 million kroner, $4 million, and they set up this Institute of Paideia. And this person, as they said in the clip, that she was born in America, and then she went to Israel, and her husband was a rabbi, and he got a job in Stockholm synagogue. So that's why she came to Stockholm, and she needed something to do, as someone told us.
Let's make Sweden multicultural. That'll be fun.
Yeah.
Let's
so do she that. Got to be, yeah, so she got to be the headmaster of this Paideia Institute.
Right.
And now, and since then, she has been working so, you know, intense to do everything to make Sweden more multicultural. And what is really also shocking, you know, I have written so many articles about the Muslim harassment of Jews, which I think is horrible, horrible. I don't want people in my country harassing people in the streets just because they wear a kippah or a Star of David or whatever. I don't want that. So I've been writing a lot of articles about that, but what is actually going on now is that the Paideia Institute, the Barbara Spector's Institute, they are working closely together with Muslim organizations in Sweden. They have, I don't know if you have the picture where Barbara Spector and someone who is a boss of a Muslim organization, they're all standing together doing the Tawhid finger, you know, one God.
Jeez.
There is only one God. A lot of Muslims and Jews, they think that we Christians, we are not, we don't believe in one God. The Trinity, they believe, is that we believe in three gods.
Right.
Yeah. So, that was a horrible, experience, finding out who Barbara Spector really was and what she has been doing in Sweden for so many years. And she has, you know, gone under the radar for so many years. No Swedes know about her, but her institute, they have connections inside the government, so they know exactly what to do. They know exactly how to pull the strings and get what they want. And they don't need to be known by Swedes. They prefer not to be known by Swedes.
You're right. I mean, it's like it's about holding power more behind the scenes of not being out in the open, because this clip that we watched from the Israeli broadcasting company or agency, whatever they're called, it was never meant to be for the consumption of every, you know, European out there. This was for their own television show, of basically tracking, monitoring, like, what is it like for Jewish people in Sweden? Is it good? Also then in line with what David Schwartz kind of advocated for, that, you know, the more multicultural it is, the better it's going to be for our group, because we can kind of, you know, we'll blend in, we'll not be the only group that's targeted and these kinds of things. Although there's a price for, I guess, what should we call them, lower class Jews that, for example, live in Malmö, where they actually are targeted in these kinds of capacities. Yes. By Muslims on the street when they see that they wear their yarmulke or whatever. But it's not about that. It's about the bigger, more important goal, it seems like, almost, of making sure that Sweden is forever transformed, you know, and that we go from an ethnically homogenous nation to a multicultural one. And look at the damage. I mean, we, Ingrid, for Christ's sake, and to everyone out there listening and watching this, ask yourself, why are we not supposed to be able to talk about this? Why are we not able to recognize that this is what's happening? And those who have themselves, it's not us, they have declared themselves our enemies. They are saying somehow it's wrong for us to just remain Swedish in our own country. And that she doesn't preface how we're going to survive with all these people. It's actually quite the opposite. We're actually demographically in decline because of it. I see this as a crime. I said this is a crime towards humanity. It's a crime towards Sweden, turning it into this very incredibly unsafe country. Yes. And she should be held responsible for her advocacy of this.
Absolutely. And what I really fear, because I am sure, I'm sure, I know that so many, you know, normal Swedish Jews, the ones who are not in the lead, who are not chairmen of different Jewish organizations, not rabbis in the synagogue and so on, normal Jews. I talked to quite a few of them. They are really, really scared of what is going on in Sweden. They're scared of this Muslim mass immigration. They are scared that they're going to be beat up and so on. But if you ask them, please, can you tell me? I'm a journalist. Can you tell me? I want to write about this. They all say, no, I can't talk to you about this. You have to speak to the rabbi. You have to speak to the chairman of the Jewish organization and so on. And I wonder why. Why are they so scared? Okay, you can say most Swedes are scared too. We don't want to talk. A lot of people of Swedish don't want to talk because they're afraid they will lose their jobs and so on. But if you are a minority in a country and you see that things are going wrong, where should you have your loyalty? Why, if these Jews who are scared of Muslim immigration, they're scared to be beaten up and so on, why don't they go with the Swedes? Why do they go to the leaders of their synagogues and their organizations who are doing exactly what they are afraid of? And that right. is something that, you know, scares me, because I always thought that Jewish people in Sweden, they were Swedish. They were just like, okay, we pray to another God and so on, but we are Swedish first and foremost. And when I hear them saying that they don't want to talk about it, I have to speak to the rabbi or some other person who is in charge of what the Jews think, then I get scared. Because this is not how you build a country. This is not democracy. This is not, you know, solidarity between the people. And it makes me scared.
Yeah, definitely. And there's other examples, Ingrid. I mean, let me just talk about this for a moment. We had another official working for the Swedish government, telling us that there is no such thing as a native Swedish culture. You know, and I found out it's not, you know, it's just, I didn't go look for this stuff. It was just these people, you know, come with their ridiculous accusations against us as a people. And then I find out that this woman, Ingrid Lundfors, she just, you know, A.N. happened to be educated in Jerusalem at the Hebrew University there. She's Jewish. She was trained at the Hebrew College in Boston. And she's even the general secretary at the Jewish synagogue or the Jewish community in Stockholm. And she, in one of her speeches, as I said, talking about these points of, you know, she's the head of living history, as it's called in Sweden, telling us that immigration is nothing new. We're all a consequence of immigration. And there isn't actually any domestic or like native Swedish culture. I mean, this is, it's like, stay out of this. why are you talking about these things? I mean, it's just such radical, you know, attitudes here. She's sitting in front of the Swedish king, even, who's at this lecture with her, lecturing us that there is no Swedish culture. I mean, what the hell is this?
It's preposterous. Who did this woman think she is? She's standing in front of the Swedish king and queen and saying there is no such thing as a Swedish culture.
Yeah.
Everything is from abroad. I mean, that I was sick. I was sick when I saw the king and queen, you know, clapping.
Yep, exactly. And
it is absolutely crazy. And this woman, I think that she believed, because this has, you could do this for so many years in Sweden. The Swedes never protested. They could say anything about us. You don't have a culture, you don't have a language, you don't have a history, the Vikings were never there, blah, 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 blah. And all we said was, okay, okay, okay. This is not your country. Okay, okay. All the people in the world need your country. Okay, okay. This has been going on for so many years, so I'm actually not surprised that she thought that she could stand in front of the king and the queen and say there is no such thing as a Swedish culture. But actually, that blew up in her face. Because a lot of Swedes, they you know, they just got crazy when they heard her. Because people, I mean, we might be very docile and very, you know, banged down in our shoes or whatever you call it in English.
Yeah, passive to a certain extent, but yeah.
Yeah, but this actually made the Swedes really angry.
Good.
So it was all over the news the next day that, what is she talking about? Of course there's a Swedish culture and so on. So she actually, the next day, she had to go out and say, oh, I'm sorry, that's not what I meant. I just meant that... of course, the Swedish culture has had influences from other cultures and so on.
Yeah. It's amazing, Ingrid, you know, that they have gotten away with it so long, but they're not doing that anymore. But if we for a moment then go back to this point that we're talking about Spectre and your reactions to these kinds of things. And again, you ended up on a trail where you basically started, you know, questioning certain things and discovering certain aspects and saying, what is this? You know, what is there any truth to these rumors? Because as you said, initially you were basically, you know, shocked, but you were also kind of standoffish and like, this woman doesn't hold any power. It's a moot point. It doesn't matter. It doesn't apply. But then the more you looked into it, you realize that she is not the only one. There's many others.
Yeah.
There is a trail here. There's people. And, you know, I see it as your right to investigate historical instances. I see it as your right to come to your own conclusions when it comes to information. We've seen in the past how dangerous it is when people accept, government propaganda and stance on history and telling its people this or that for whatever political, you know, gain. And it is up to us. It is up to journalists to question and look into these kinds of things. But unfortunately, the climate has been so restrictive and so hard around certain things that, you know, they've started to legislate against it. And this is really the battle that we're in right now when it comes to, you know, freedom of speech on not only Facebook with all these fake news accusations, but also YouTube and on Google and these kinds of things. And, you know, I'm one who's basically want to open up the issue of free speech to anyone who wants to question. I think that anything goes in this matter, as long as it doesn't, you know, physically, you know, hurt people or whatever. None of this mental stuff that is, some people are hurt emotionally by, you know, what someone thinks or whatever. That's just, you know, bullshit.
Yeah.
But I think, Ingrid, that we should be able to question these things and present the evidence to people and say, listen, don't take my word for it. Look into it for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
See what conclusion you can come to. And that's the stance that you've held on this all along. But see, that's not enough for people. You are to be morally lambasted. You're to be morally shamed for your position. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. So what happened after this person that I told you about before, Jan Funnesson, when he wrote this blog about me being an anti-Semite and so on, then it's all, you know, it's just spinned on. And people were saying all sorts of crazy stuff, and then suddenly I was a Holocaust denier. Because someone said, I wrote an email to her and asked her about the Holocaust. And she said, well, there are some strange things that doesn't, fit. That doesn't, make sense. So then I was a Holocaust denier. And then it just sort of spinned off. And I had no way of stopping it. So in 6 hours, I was the most horrible Holocaust denier in Sweden. I never denied the Holocaust. I don't know everything about the Holocaust, but what I do know is that now I know a lot more than I did a few years ago. Because the rest of Westerners, I always believed that what I was taught in school was the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And then when I started my journey on this, which started with Barbara Spector, and then, you know, if you start looking into something, then you get curious and you want to look at another thing. And then I found things that didn't add up. And I said, what is this? Could it be that I, the person who wants to, you know, dig into everything, this has been a blind spot for me that I could never, ever, if someone had told me, do you know that there might be some things about the Holocaust that doesn't add up, I would have said, 5 years ago, you're crazy, you're horrible, you're Nazi, go away. Could it be that me, the brave journalist who wants to look into everything, was there a blind spot inside me, something that made me scared so I couldn't look at these things? And then I really got angry with myself, because that's not the way I look at myself. I want to be brave. I want to look into everything. But, of course, I'm not stupid. I know that this is the most dangerous topic of all.
Right. And, I've questioned why that is. I frankly, personally haven't seen the level of seriousness behind it, because, let's just face it, people are not this scared to discuss whether Stalin murdered, 60 million or 20 million, right? I mean, we don't have to get into the mechanics of this. I'm just trying to put this forth as a exercise of us being able to look into history, to question history, to lay forth dissident opinions, contradictory opinions, and say, what's going on? Let's come to our own conclusions around this. And let's look at that data, which is we find interesting, which is held out of the mainstream and these kinds of things. I think it's worth it for the sake of accuracy, for the sake of truth, for the sake of really knowing this guilt cloud that's held over us today. That as soon as we begin to organize as an ethnic group and have interest, supposedly that always turns into some Holocaust, right? But we have to be able to question this, shouldn't we?
Of course. And that's why I think, I mean, many people tell me, why do you want to dig into the Holocaust? It's so many years ago. It doesn't matter today. Just leave it alone. If there was something wrong about the story, just leave it alone. It doesn't matter. But I think it do matters. Because everything we do today, if we, as you said, if we try to organize ourselves, if we say that I'm Swede and I'm proud to be Swede, I love my country, Sweden is the country of the Swedes, and I want us to take our country back, then I will always hear, oh, so you want another Holocaust? Is that what you want? You're a Nazi. Everyone who is a patriot, a nationalist, is a Nazi. And that leads to wanting to gas the Jews.
Right, right. It's
silly. So that's why I do think it's important, even if it's so many years ago. It is important because it's there, every time you try to say, I love my country, then they always come the Holocaust.
Yeah, you're a Nazi, right? So, you are going to do what the National Socialists did, supposedly. And then you're like, okay, well, let's just talk about that then and see what is the crime. Is it true? But despite all those things, it doesn't equate to that. It doesn't equate to that we want to do the same thing that the Nazi Germany did in the 1930s. It's a different time. It's 70 years ago. It's not applicable, but they're so paranoid about this that it's almost like they just can't leave it alone. It's just always back to that point, always back to that point. But regardless, I just think out of sake of accuracy and truth that we should be able to question this. As we know, Ingrid, I mean, in some countries, it's against the law to question these things. If people actually end up in jail, they are imprisoned. I mean, this is, if there's a topic for free speech advocates, this would be the topic for this issue. And I know it's very emotional, I know it's difficult, it's all these different things. But the fact is, I don't think that you should legally, or rather legislate against people's inquiry into a historic event. I just don't see the function of that, to be honest.
No, and it's just a few years ago that I really understood how forbidden it is in Germany to even say that I have doubts. I doubt, some details in the story of the Holocaust. That's forbidden. And when I really realized this, I was so shocked. And I said, Germany is a democracy. They have the rule of law, it's supposed to be free speech and everything. How is it possible that people are thrown in jail in Germany for saying, I studied this, And I came up to with another conclusion. How could that be against the law? And I want, if you could show a little clip where it shows that even the lawyers who defend the people who said that something is wrong in this picture, they also get thrown in jail.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's take a look at this, folks.
Ich möchte meinen Vortrag mit einem Satz beginnen, mit demselben, mit dem ich ihn auch beenden werde. Denn ich halte diesen Satz für den, in diesem Satz wird der Kern des menschlichen Wesens, des Menschseins dargestellt, meines Erachtens. Denken, was wahr, und fühlen, was schön, und wollen, was gut ist. Darin erkennt der Geist das Ziel des vernünftigen Lebens.
So, Ingrid, this is very an important case, Sylvia Stoltz in Germany, and she was, as the clip explained, a defense attorney for Ernst Zundel. There was a big trial called the Great Holocaust Trial. It's still on YouTube. I definitely recommend people to look at that one. Very interesting. It's one of the only trials that have ever been, and there was a remarkable amount of, you know, evidence that came out. I know that there was another lawyer in Canada at the time, which I forget the name of, that also was included, and he was also a free speech advocate in Canada and knew a lot of things. But Sylvia Stoltz, as pointed out here, of course, has been imprisoned just for defending her client. I mean, what's going on here? This is remarkable.
Well, it's absolutely horrifying. I mean, a lawyer is supposed to speak out for her defendant. She is supposed to make the best speech ever for her defendant, the person that she is representing. And in Germany, it's forbidden for a lawyer to try to make her best for the defendant. She was actually, if you are defending a person who denied even part of the Holocaust, you don't need to, you know, deny everything about the Holocaust. Just, I don't remember what Aaron Sundel's case was, but for example, let's say that you don't believe in a tiny piece of the story. Let's say that you don't believe in the soap and the lampshades. If you say that, you can go to prison, and if you have a lawyer, the lawyer can't defend you. The lawyer is forbidden to say, well, there is some Jewish historians who said that this is absolutely not true. If she says that, if the lawyer says that, she will go to prison. What is this? In Europe? In our days? What is going on? When I found this out, I got really, really scared, and I thought, there is something here that doesn't add up, because if everything is true, why would you be scared of someone, you know, scrutinizing the evidence? Why would you be afraid? If you know that everything is true and solid, why would you say to someone, it's forbidden to say something about it, and why would you say to the lawyer, you can't defend your client?
Right, I mean, truth shouldn't fear any investigation, as they say. But you don't think that there would be a problem with this. But as you've kind of stated already, in Germany, it's law according to what happened. And so if you question that law, then it's illegal by technicalities. So, of course, it's a specific kind of circumstance in Germany and some of the other Central European countries. It's not as bad in Sweden, as far as I understand it, but it's still bad enough when it comes to the social ostracization that happens and that occurs when people mm-hmm. start, you know, to question these kinds of things. So, you know, Sylvia Stoltz is a good example of what could happen if you just basically try to defend someone who has, you know, questions about this kind of stuff. What else was it that you looked at that made you, because as you say, I mean, people say, okay, well, now you're a Holocaust denier, which is, of course, is a straw man argument. It's going to the furthest extreme that you possibly can. to try to basically demonize you as a person instead of saying, what do you actually say? What do you propose? I see the line, are you a Holocaust denier? Kind of like, when did you stop beating your wife? It's like there's no way out of the situation.
No.
You've never denied that there wasn't a campaign to, round up Jews in Germany in the 1930s, or that they, lived, through horrible conditions or anything like that. There's other aspects of it, and there, it's testimony and things like that. But what do you think people should reasonably question? What was curious to you when you started looking into this?
Well, the thing was that, as all other Westerners, I was taught in school that this and this and this happened, and it's the most horrible thing of all. And I remember as a child, I asked my parents, why did they do this? Why did Hitler hate the Jews? Why did the Germans do this? I don't understand it. Just because they believed in another God? And the only answer I got was, well, they went crazy. And you know, this, I think this is what they want you to believe. They want you to believe that all the Germans, they suddenly got crazy. There was no, the Jews never did anything. Hitler was crazy, and he made all the German people crazy. So, but there was something that was stuck in my heart, like, I don't really understand it. I always need to understand why things happen. And so, but for a lot of years, I just shut it out because it was, it's too dangerous to even get close to it. But what actually happened when it started with the Barbara Streisand clip, and then I got some other clips, and I went out on YouTube and I found other things. And then I realized that there are some aspects of this Holocaust story that doesn't add up. For example, a lot of people still believe that the Nazis made soap and lampshades out of dead Jews. This story has been debunked since, I think, many years by Jewish historians, among them Deborah Lipstadt, who is famous because she was in trial with Holocaust denier David Irving. So Deborah Lipstadt and some other Jewish historians, they have proved that this story about soap and lampshades, it's not true. And even though they did it, most people still believe that the Nazis made soap and lampshades out of Jewish bodies. And if you say to people that that is a lie, they go crazy on you. they start, saying all sorts of horrible things to you. And it doesn't even help if you show them that Jewish historians have said that this is a lie. This never happened. They just don't want to believe you.
You know, there's more in it, like the accusations of the shrunken heads. I don't know if you saw that. Supposedly, during the denazification period, they paraded all these objects, including the lampshades, as we can see here, but also shrunken heads, that the Nazi has nothing better to do, than to do, these kinds of bizarre experiments. As they're fighting a two-front war and basically are collapsing in on themselves, they have the time to, shrink heads and do all these weird things. And it's just, it's preposterous. And there's other things surrounding this too, which I think proves that we should be allowed to question so-called survivors or eyewitness testimony. Because obviously the reasoning dictate itself, none that are alive to tell the story were killed, right? I mean, that's the logical conclusion with it. So they've seen something or something which resembles these kinds of things. Were there any of these eyewitness testimonies that stood out to you, Ingrid, as kind of, I don't know, preposterous?
Well, of course, I've seen a lot of them. And of course, I've seen the Henry, or what's it called, Rosenblatt, who He was famous. He was on the Oprah Winfrey show telling the whole world about how his later wife, she was standing outside the fence of Auschwitz and throwing apples at him. And the whole world said, oh, what a fantastic story. And then we found out that it was just a lie.
So let's play that here.
Of survival in the Nazi concentration camps, a story that is genuinely extraordinary. But as he explained to us in this exclusive interview, he felt he needed to make things up to get people to pay attention.
The greatest love story we've ever told on this show.
Herman Rosenblatt received international attention for his story about being a hungry little boy in a Nazi concentration camp who was thrown apples every day by a little girl on the other side of the fence. Years later, according to the story, Rosenblatt met that same girl on a blind date in New York City, and he proposed on the spot.
They used to come by every day, bring the apple, have in my jacket, and a piece of bread, and he used to say, I'll see you tomorrow.
The story landed Herman and Roma Rosenblatt on Oprah twice, and in newspapers all over the world. They also got a book and movie deal. But the story wasn't true.
Why did you do it? Why did you tell such a big lie to so many people for so long?
It wasn't a lie. It was my imagination. And in my imagination, in my mind, I believed it.
What more can you say, Ingrid? I mean, in my mind, I believed it, so therefore,
yeah.
Whatever, it's real, right?
But this is actually scary, because I have talked to Jews today, talking to them about how come that again and again we see Jews talking about someone carving out, the swastika on their doors and so on, and then the police finds out that it wasn't true. They did it themselves. And when I talk to Jews, they say, well, it doesn't matter, because even if this wasn't true, there is so much anti-Semitism, so it's good that someone does it to point to the anti-Semitism. And, you know, what? What are you saying? Are you actually condoning people, you know, lying and making things up because you think you have a bigger goal? And to me, that is just like a crooked cop, you know, planting evidence because he knows that this guy is the killer. So it's, if we can't frame him, if we can't, get him into prison, then more girls will be killed and raped and so on. So it's a good thing that I plant this DNA or something like that. And we will say, no, that's not the way to do it. You're a crooked cop. You can't do this. But Jews, some Jews, not all Jews, but some Jews, they think it's good. Because even though it wasn't true, they did the swastika themselves, but it was a good thing because there is so much anti-Semitism, so it's a good thing to pretend that this was true, because then the whole world would see how great anti-Semitism is.
Right, exactly. The Nazis are out there. It's happening. This is a really dangerous, you know, aspect. So we can basically kind of just add on a little bit to show people that it's really there, right? But from our point of view, then you're like, oh, well, okay, well, what else is wrong then, right? What else has been exaggerated, or what else can should we be allowed to question here? Because, you know, there are a lot of other testimony too, and I think we could take a look at a couple of them to just kind of see, like, and people can make their own conclusions. We're not trying to, you know, instill in you and tell you what to think about these things. We just want you to look honestly at these things and make up your own mind and question, are these viable, you know, testimony, or is this reality that they're describing here, or are these exaggerations, right? So let's take a look.
The whole time I was in the camp through the experiment, every time I was selected, I swallowed the diamonds. So every time I swallowed them, I had to find them again. We were allowed to go to the latrine once a day. And I never sat in the hole because I had to go and find my diamonds. And one day the assess woman walked by the door and she saw me in the corner. And I already had the diamonds in the hand, and usually I was waiting until on the way back I would rinse them off, like in the mud, or if there was no mud, in the soup that we were going to get next. But I had no time and I had to swallow them.
Everybody is telling you, told us, don't eat, because it's hard to die when they give you the gas because your stomach is so full.
Scheifler visited a German pharmacy after the war to buy some soap.
So this was 6 months after the war. They were selling Jew soap, made of Jew soap, not from the concentration camps. So tell me, who were the Germans?
Now, when you got to Auschwitz with your mother, you said you went into what you thought was a shower room, but actually it was a gas chamber.
We walked in, we were trembling. A little while later, water came through. Ice cold water, wonderful. We drank it, we were so dry, thirsty. And we showered ourselves, and then the water stopped. We came out of there, and the women who worked there screamed, "Oh, you are alive! How wonderful to see you!" And embracing us. I said, "What are you talking? Why are you so shouting?" But they said, "Don't you know where you've been?" I said, "No, where? You were in the gas chamber."
It's like a room. You think it's a shower with shower heads and tiles, maybe split naked. But you know that it's not water coming out, but gas.
We knew we were going to the gas chamber, right? But by some miracle, I don't know how, what, when, water came down instead of the gas.
There were signs there on the wall that you should tie your shoes together and hang them up with your clothes so that we come out of the disinfection, you can find them again. There were shower heads in the ceiling, but never did any shower, any water come out of them. They were just to a camouflage of the real intentions.
By some miracle, I don't know how, what, when, water came down instead of the gas.
We never knew when we took a shower whether water is going to come out or gas.
So they said for every person that's going to take their lives, they're going to torture to death 5 of us.
Then they punished us. For every man that ran through the wire, they took 100 inmates and they killed them in front of everybody as an example. They didn't even let us die when we wanted.
Spielberg's character exaggerates 20 times from her original story, but screws up and still holds up the same amount of fingers.
You put about 4. It takes 30, 40 minutes to burn them.
That would take more like 4 hours. He lies about the cremation rate to obscure the fact that 15 ovens isn't enough to handle 2,000 bodies. And when that's established, the overall number of 500,000 can't be true either. Because Holocaust historians tell us that Crematorium II wasn't in operation until spring 1943, and ending in November 1944. It was only supposedly in operation for a year and a half. They tell us that 500,000 people were killed in this building. But because of the slow cremation rate, that's not enough time to kill that many people. 15 ovens would not have been enough even if they had been these computerized ovens. So the first thing to notice is incredibly bad design. 2,000 Jews go in here, go through this narrow passage into the gas chamber. Why not have it be above ground? This is the undressing room, and this is the gas chamber, and have 4 large doors between so that 500 people can go through each door, totaling 2,000. Then 4 large doors open up on the right side, where there is a conveyor belt that takes the bodies to a blast furnace. When the bodies here are removed, carts on wheels are then brought in for the heavy job of moving the 1,700 remaining bodies to the conveyor belt. Carts on wheels, because even a smaller man of 135 pounds is equal to 3 plates in the gym, which is draggable but slow going, and one would get tired quickly. So how did they do it in this 100-foot elongated room? if, say, they had 700 bodies left to haul out down at the end of the gas chamber and had to move them 70 feet to the door?
So, when they would open the doors of the gas chamber, whose job was it to take the bodies out?
Well, they give us some canes. You reverse the cane and you put it in there. And you drag them out, because when the gas, they get very, very tight and takes a lot of force to be able to drag the bodies from the gas chambers, you know, to put it in the elevator going on the second floor.
Dragging with canes instead of using wheels? Not believable. There's also the bad design of taking everyone underground, just to have the problem of then taking all their bodies back up to ground level.
The crematoriums were not big enough, and they could only burn about 1,000 bodies each day. But in the pit, they could burn up to 15,000. In the three pits, they were very large pits, around 6 to 8 meters long and about 2 meters wide. And in each pit, they threw in 1,000 people. And it only took a few minutes to burn them completely. Maybe 30 minutes and they were completely burned. Or partly burned. There were still a few hands or feet that had fallen out to the side. And we had to put them back on the fire.
And a lot of us were lucky enough to be selected for work. I was selected for experiments. 15 of us one morning were selected. We had to undress outside. And we had and this doctor, this German doctor, examined our body, and they took us out because we had no blemished bodies. They wanted people with smooth skin and no blemishes on the skin.
Do you remember the name of the doctor? Did you ever hear it?
No, it could have been Eichmann, it could have been Mengele. You know, after a while, they all looked the same. And then finally, we got to the fourth experiment, the third experiment, which was they selected the five of us, and they again with the smooth skin. And she said, "Well, I hate to tell you this, but I think that Ilse Koch, that was taking the human skin and making gloves and lampshades, that she was coming to Majdanek to select her material for the lampshades, and we have the skin for it." And she said to me, "Let's go back to the barrack and not go here." And I said, "Well, are they going to let us do that?" She says, "No, they're going to kill us, but it's better to die here than going to Majdanek and let them skin our skin." I said, "They're going to skin our skin? Why?" And she said, "Because there is an SS woman, and she's a maniac. She has to be a maniac to do this. She likes human gloves made out of human skin and lampshades and God knows what else she does."
But there was an active underground in Auschwitz, and every day the women who worked in this gunpowder, with gunpowder in the factory, they smuggled out pinches of gunpowder in very special crevices in their bodies. The news reached us by way of the grapevine that the reason we no longer can work in gas chamber and crematorium number 4 is because it was blown up and put out of action. We were jubilant.
See, they had a live orchestra. Jewish people played live orchestra. And whenever a transport came, a new transport arrived, and they were making the selection and burning people, the music played. Many for a long time, when I would hear music, I started to cry. People wouldn't understand why. And I love music. You can see I have lots of tapes and things. But because I always remembered. So the barbarism. Can you imagine killing people in music playing? And with Mengele and with others, nurses were giving injection for children because it wasn't always the gas chambers. I was told this I didn't experience because when I came, unfortunately, they had the gas chambers. But before, they used the gas vents, they gave injections, you know, in the heart.
But suddenly, SS, who was guarding there, you know, they had bayonets on there. And the banditis ran after the child. And he caught the child. He tore out the bottle of water, threw it away, and he toasted the child in the sky and picked it up on his bayonet. And he smashed his head against the wall.
They need that long nails. That size, and my little finger thick, and they nailed it in my head. That was hurting like crazy. I was screaming, and I was going in a coma, and then I finally come out, and there was that nail in there. The Nazis, they were fleeing, so they nailed us to the walls or hung us. I was hanged like that at the wall, and with a chain here that is made out of knives. So when you move, you cut yourself. That's why I have that cut here on my chain.
You know, some religious Jews who had beards would put on a kerchief so they would hide the beard, because I remember the first time when I saw they were pulling the hairs one by one. Another time I saw that they cut just a half and they leave the others just to mock us.
Can you describe for us the very first thing you remember when that door opened up to the wagon?
The first thing that I remember is that the SS always is schnell, schnell, schnell. Right, you know, we got into line, and there were, Mengele was there making the selection, always with his two fingers.
I think that was Mengele that took me out of there. And he just attached me to that gypsy prison, and I went to the gas chamber. And as I was going into the gas chamber, you know, everybody was being pushed into the gas chamber. And I was going backwards. Somehow I was being pushed backwards. And I was like stuck in the door. And I don't know, I guess God told me to do that.
Mengele stopped me with his stick and said, "You, come here." And I came and he said, "Are you Jewish?" And I was very tall for my age. I think that's why he noticed me. And also I had thick, long blonde braids. And that was a typical Aryan girl. You know, the German ideal of the pure race. So that's why he asked me if I was Jewish. And I said, "Yes, of course I'm Jewish." So it's such an insane thing to remember this, that Mengele, who was sending thousands and thousands and probably tens of thousands to their death, stopped and took time out to save my life at that moment, simply because I was blonde and I had blonde braids and I had blue eyes, and maybe I looked like the Aryan ideal.
Dr. Joseph Mengele, the notoriously evil Nazi doctor, was looking for entertainment. The girls in the barracks volunteered the only accomplished ballerina among them, Edith.
And I ended up dancing for Dr. Mengele. But I closed my eyes and I pretended that I was dancing the Romeo and Juliet at the Budapest Opera House.
That dancing for Mengele saved your life.
It did, and he gave me a piece of bread, which I shared with the girls.
some people you meet change you forever. She's one of them. Edith tells me that she still dances to this day. Her message of hope and love over evil has brought her to speak all over the world, and a book on her life is coming out.
Okay, we saw some eyewitnesses, and that's one of the, you know, the comments. Most of the comments I've had on Facebook and Twitter after this, you know, this story about me being a Holocaust denier, which I'm not, but anyway, so many people say to me, haven't you seen the eyewitness? Just look at their stories, and then you will understand that this all happened just as they said it happened. And then I just want to ask you, how come that we know from so many research studies that eyewitnesses are not to be trusted? That is why when you go to trial, the prosecutor need to have real evidence. They cannot just trust the victim, if the victim is still alive, or someone who was an eyewitness. They need some forensic evidence. Because you cannot trust eyewitnesses. Everybody knows that. If it's a trial about a killer or a rapist or anything, you know you cannot trust eyewitnesses. They can be part of the proof, but it cannot be the only proof. But still people say to me, you have to listen to the survivors. If you just listen to the survivors, then you will understand that everything is true. And we have just seen so many survivors saying preposterous things. Everybody understands that this is not true. So as it is all over the place, you cannot trust eyewitnesses.
Yeah, I mean, some people say, well, are you saying that some of these people are you saying that they're lying? And it's like, yeah. You know, it's just,
yeah.
That's how simple it is. Actually, I am. Because, you know, as Normal Finkenstein and others have pointed out, the Holocaust has actually become a history. And much of Israel's dependency on economic aid from Germany, for example, has been tremendously important. And it has actually held up. By this industry, by the Holocaust industry. And again, it doesn't mean that there wasn't people that were hurt or displaced or you know, probably horrible things happened to them. It's not about denying all, you know, those things separately. It's about the fact that it has now, the history itself has been weaved into a political agenda, a emotional agenda, a much bigger aspect. And I'm not saying, personally, I don't know if these people are communicating with each other and saying, yeah, let's lie about this, or if it's just, you know, they get fed these things. Many of these people that speak out today, they were like 5, 6, 7 years old when some of this stuff happened. You know, mm-hmm. They were young. They were, I mean, imagine yourself being like, being told at that age, it was like people, your whole group, they wanted to exterminate your whole group. I mean, I can imagine that that's traumatizing. I've seen footage of Israelis going to, you know, Auschwitz and these places and literally being like induced into this emotional state of what you're supposed to feel when you're there and things like this. I'm not saying it's easy for some of those young people that are going through this programming today either. But nonetheless, we have to be in a position where we can gather these testimonies, gather these stories and say, listen, this is enough of evidence for us to initiate an interest to look into this further. I mean, even look at it from an insurance point of view claim, right? That if they're now receiving money from this, an insurance company would continue to question your claim again and again to make sure that you're not lying when you're receiving money. So I think that this is a healthy approach that we should have to this issue, and especially when people have been caught lying, that's a red flag and a herring in itself that we have to follow through on, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't believe, you know, they say that, what do you think that all the Jews in the world are in sort of a world conspiracy? No, I don't think that. I think that stories like this make people, you know, there are some people who are very easily, what's it called, suggestible?
Right.
Yeah, and if you are a Jew and maybe you feel that you too want to be part of this story, you want people to feel sorry for you, you want to become someone, you want to be special, then you start thinking about this, and you say, well, like the crooked cup, you say, well, maybe I didn't experience this, but somebody else did, so it's okay for me to do it. And all these people are not like that. That's not what I'm saying. But among these people, of course, there are some who will, you know, take advantage of this story. And that is why I tell everybody, don't believe everything you hear, everything you read. There are some things about this story that doesn't add up, and you have a responsibility for yourself. If you are a European and you care about your own people, because we are the ones that are constantly being bashed for, you know, we did this. Okay, we didn't do it, but our parents or our grandparents. And so we are, you know, we are in a position where we can't even defend ourselves. So therefore, we have an obligation to look into this, to see what is right and what is wrong. That is all I'm saying. We, as intelligent people, we have to look into this story. We can't just let other people say to us, you did this, and end of story. And don't question it, because if you do, you are an anti-Semite, and you will start gassing Jews again. We can't stand that anymore.
I totally agree. I think it's a way that we can question these things in a rational way, which is not, you know, hateful or completely irrational or out of left field. I think as all subjects, there's a intelligent approach to it, and you question it, and you go through it methodically, and just like anything. But there are a lot of, you know, strange things around this. I mean, even we were talking before we came on here, Ingrid, about, for example, the 6 million figure itself. I remember seeing a video a couple of years ago. Someone pointed out all these papers going back to as early as, this particular one is from 1915, but there's even back to the late 1800s, where they actually discussed this issue in the papers that 6 million Jews have been, you know, targeted in some way, and it's paper after paper after paper, and these makes you kind of question as well, right? If it's like, well, wait a minute, if this was not true back then with those 6 million, how can we know that it's true the latest incarnation that they said that this was true? What do you think about something when you see this kind of stuff?
Well, you know, I was brought up with 6 million Jews were gassed to death. And I thought that everybody who questioned that was a crazy person or a cruel person, a horrible person, an evil person. So it was really, really hard for me to even start looking into this. But then I found out, as you said, this when I saw all these newspapers talking about 6 million Jews are to perish because of starvation and a lot of different things. So apparently 6 million Jews is sort of a holy figure in Judaism. And then I found out that after the war, the Red Cross, they made a list of how many people they estimated had died in the concentration camps, and I think that was about 300,000 or 400,000 people, and that was the official figures for many years. And then suddenly something happened, and then the figure 6 million came up. And how did they come up with the figure 6 million? Well, they counted the deaths in the so-called extermination camps. And the worst of them was Auschwitz. And the Russians, who then occupied Poland, where Auschwitz is situated, they said that 4 million people were killed in Auschwitz. So the Russians said 6 million. Among them were 4 million from Auschwitz. And the Allied said 6 million. And among them were 4 million in Auschwitz. And then when the wall came down and Poland and Russia became democracies and the communism was gone, then Auschwitz said, no, 4 million was wrong. So they took it down to 1.5 million, and now it's 1.1 million. But still, the total is 6 million Jews. And maybe I am totally stupid, Henrik. But I don't understand. If you have 6 million and you take almost 3 million from that total and you still have 6 million, can you explain that to me? Because I really don't get it.
Yeah, I don't get it either. It's very strange, you know, that they can change so radically and millions of numbers are changed. And yet, after all, just the overarching picture of how many perished in this atrocity of World War II, why does it remain the same? I mean, it's a reasonable question. It's a logical question to ask. And as you said, many people go to this route. Well, it's not about that, or that doesn't matter. Actually, it does matter. It does very much matter. What is true? I mean, if this is a documented, provable extermination campaign, I think we should know about that, and that evidence for that should be presented instead of us solely relying on somewhat dubious testimony and what seems to be kind of an occult, esoteric number that they've been trying to kind of put forth for for many, many years, for decades before this was supposedly happened. So I have a lot of questions. I don't know. I don't have all the stories about this. I simply just think that there's a lot of things around this that we simply don't know, weaved into it. You have economic incentive, political incentive, you have, a number of different things, and it's become what they call a Gordian knot today. It's like almost an unsolvable, difficult, labyrinth to go through. But I think we have enough material that suggests that something is not quite right. Something is not as we're being told. Now, exactly what the truth is, that I think we should continue to investigate and try to find what was it, right?
Of course, that is the only thing I want. I don't deny that there was a Holocaust. I don't say that everything that we have been taught is a lie. I just say I have seen some things that doesn't add up. I have seen things that are lies. I have seen things that I don't believe in because they are preposterous. So why don't we let historians dig into this and really see, are these people, the so-called Holocaust deniers, like David Irving and Faurisson and whatever their names are, why don't you put together a group of people trying to find out what really happened? Why is this so difficult? Why is this so dangerous?
We could go on about this for a long time. There's a lot of material. People have been talking about this for decades. We're not going to solve it in a 1.5-hour show. It's just ridiculous to perceive that. I just hope that we've encouraged the viewer or aroused enough curiosity that the viewer themselves say, okay, well, I'm going to look into some of the things that they say and investigate for themselves, as opposed to just saying, you know what, you guys are crazy, you're hateful bigots, and I'm going to listen to what you say. Do some investigations. Look into it for yourself. See what your conclusion is. Is there any truth to this, right? We just want to arouse, interest in this topic. And it shouldn't be, off the table to question these kinds of things. But I think one of the more important things I wanted to ask you about is just kind of on a personal note, how the impact of this has been for you. For, as you said before, I mean, you've looked into what happened, when you're starting to look at the Muslim question and the mass immigration into Sweden and all these kinds of things. What happened this time when you started looking at this kind of stuff? How was the reactions and how were you met?
Well, what really happened was that, of course, I knew that when this came up, when it doesn't matter how small the matter, if you say something about that you don't really believe everything about the Holocaust, then you will be trashed. Everybody, a lot of people will hate you. But what happened was that a lot of my friends, sort of, Facebook friends and so on, who really have been applauding my work against Islamization, they suddenly said, "We hate you." They don't ask me, "Why are you doing this? Can you tell me what happened? What did you find out?" They're not curious. They just say, "I hate you." You've done something so horrible. Now you have proven that you are a horrible person. So they don't care that they have been following me, applauding me for 5 or 6 years. Suddenly, in an hour, I am a horrible person because I'm saying something that they don't like. So then I am off the table.
What would you like, you know, people to know about? Either if it's the subject or maybe even yourself, Ingrid, in terms of like, I mean, I know you're not a hateful person. I know all these things. I know what a kind, warm person, how funny you are. It's not about, you know, any of these character assassinations that comes in the wake of something like this. We know that it's all lies. I mean, listen, we know that the establishment they're lying about practically everything. And we are on to some of these people, and we're questioning them, and we're trying to put them up against the wall and say, listen, you have some stuff to answer for here. That's all we're doing. I think that this is a reflection of their insecurity and them just not, you know, accepting a differing perspective and so forth. But what would you like the viewer to something and the listener to something like this to kind of take away with them, you know, after we've talked about all these very emotional and difficult topics, ain't it?
Well, my greatest hope is that people start thinking for themselves. That if we are going to save Europe, we all have to start thinking. Don't just believe what people are saying to you. Don't believe the politicians. Don't believe the journalists. Don't believe the teachers. Don't believe the lobbyists. Don't believe anyone. Be skeptical. And there is it has never been so easy to find out things as it is today. There is a whole internet out there, and on YouTube you can find so many movies. And I don't say, go and see one movie and then you find the truth. No, you have to watch a lot of them, and you have to think. You have to think for yourself. Watch a lot of people, watch a lot of movies, and think. And then you come up to a conclusion. And I am sure your conclusion will be, there is something fishy here, and I want a big investigation. I want to know the truth.
Well, I think that's very reasonable, Ingrid, and I just want to personally say thank you for being brave enough to talk about this for a subject that so many people shy away from. I think it's a true heroic stance, considering the fact that it is just such a difficult area to go into, and I don't wish upon anyone the things that some of these people have been subjected to, you know, throughout the decades for simply mm-hmm. bringing valid points to the table. I think, again, just to go back to that last point, and we'll wrap this up after this, but, you know, I think that they are in a defensive position. I think that they are so terrified of people questioning more about this event that they have to go to legislation to try to shut people down and imprison them and set examples for other people to say, you don't touch on this subject because then you know what is going to happen. Ultimately, though, I think it's the false tactic. I think it's a failing tactic, because the more you try to shut people down, guess what? The more they are going to want to try to find out the truth. And if someone tells you, you can visit any room in this apartment, but don't go in through, you know, door number 3 here in the hallway. That's all you're going to want to do, you know. What is behind that door? Let me peer behind it. It's just what curious, interested people do. And that's all we're asking here, folks, to be allowed to look and say, you know, make up our own mind and make up our own determination about what actually happened there. So thank you, Ingrid, for being brave. Thank you for coming on, clarifying this to us, to the viewer, of what it is that you actually think about this, as opposed to buying, you know, the BS that everyone else is trying to claim that what you think or what your opinions about this stuff is. So thank you again.
Thank you.
Ha 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 ha.